Okay, so we've heard a lot about the importance and the existence of heterogeneity in tumors. And so this is the outline of my talk. In the first part, I'm going to be discussing a stochastic branching process model of tumor growth, and I'll be talking about some mathematical analysis of some diversity measures that are coming from the field of ecology in this model. And then in the second part of the talk, I will discuss some applications of this model to look at drug resistance in tyrosine kinase inhibitors, to tyrosine kinase inhibitors in chronic myeloid leukemia, and also the system we heard about earlier in EGFR-driven non-small cell lung cancer. Okay, so this is the basic model of tumor growth that I'm going to be using. So we're going to model our tumor cell population as a binary branching process. What that means is each cell is going to wait a random amount of time before it either divides into two cells or it dies. And the rate at which births happen is A0, and the rate at which deaths happen is B0. And since we're modeling a growing tumor cell population, we're going to assume that A0 is bigger than B0, so that we've got an exponentially growing population. And just to give you some notation, Z0 of T is going to be the number of type 0 cells at time T. So we're going to start out with initially one type of cell, which we'll call type 0, and we're going to start out with one of those cells. Okay, so how do we generate diversity in this model? We're going to say that type 0 cells have the ability to mutate with a small probability U1 per unit time, and creating type 1 cells, which we're going to call Z1 of T. And then so on and so forth, type 1 cells can mutate to type 2 cells, and so on. Okay, so where does the diversity come from? Mutations in this model can confer a random change to the birth rate of the daughter cell. So if you've got your parental cell, it has fitness X, the daughter cell is going to have fitness X plus some random variable, and that random variable has some distribution G, some general distribution G, which we are sort of drawing here. So this model kind of describes one situation in which you might have, for example, a drug for which there are many different resistance mutations, and each one of these resistance mutations may confer some kind of growth advantage relative to drug-sensitive cells in the presence of treatment. And we might be interested in the generation of just sort of the diversity of the entire resistant population in the tumor. Another scenario where this can arise is sort of like what we heard about this morning. You might have one resistance mutation, but there might be heterogeneity in terms of drug response within that genetically identical group of cells. So let's see, just to give you a little bit more notation, the density of this random variables distribution here, we're going to call G, and B is the largest possible fitness advance. And later on when we talk about measures of diversity, I'll try and remember to move my computer once in a while. Okay, so later on when we talk about diversity, we're going to be discussing a lot of times the dependence of the diversity of the ensuing population on the size of our fitness advances. So that's why B is important. Okay, so here I'm going to talk about investigating diversity properties of Z1, the first sort of the type 1 cells. these results that I'll talk about are generalizable to later types of cells with more mutations, but since I'm interested in resistance driven by single point mutations in the applications, I'll confine the discussion here to diversity within the Z1 population. Okay, so this is kind of a picture just to show you a little bit about the extent of diversity that is generated by this model. So what you're looking at if we look at the top graph here, is sort of a snapshot in time of the tumor population. And each dot, each circle, represents a clone of genetically identical cells, and its location on the x-axis identifies its birth rate or its fitness, and its location on the y-axis identifies its size, and this is a log scale. And the color represents which type of cell it is, i.e. how many mutations it has. So in dark blue, we have all the cells that have one mutation. In light blue, all the cells with two mutations, and so on and so forth. So as you can see, as the number of mutations increases, we tend to get fitter cells, although this is not necessarily always the case. Generally, for this particular set of parameters, at this time point, the largest clones that we're seeing in the population, i.e. the dominant clones, are coming from sort of the earliest wave of mutants, although we are starting to see some of these clones that are coming later, i.e. from wave 4, for example, with very high fitness, being able to sort of make it up there and make up a significant fraction of the tumor. Okay, so down here, you're looking at the exact same snapshot. This is the same population, only now the coloring is different. The color here represents the time at which each of these clones is created. So as you can see, the vast majority of the clones are created just before you take the snapshot, which is the property that you'd expect from an exponentially growing population. Okay. Okay, so the first thing we wanted to do was just pin down some basic properties of this V1 population, like how fast does it grow? And so what this result says is that if we multiply the V1 population by this scaling factor, t to the power 1 plus p, p is this constant, that's b over the growth rate of the type 0 cells, and this exponential term, if we multiply these things together, then the product converges to this random variable, V1. And since this random variable is non-degenerate, it's not zero and it's not infinity, what this is telling us is that V1, this population, essentially grows like the inverse of this scaling term here. Now what's interesting about this is if we do the same thing for the expected value, i.e. the average of V1, we see that it grows like almost the same thing, only the powers of t are different. Here we've got t, and here we've got t to the 1 plus p. So in effect, the population V1 is growing slower than its mean. And so this is one of these interesting cases in modeling where the behavior of the average dynamics does not reflect the actual behavior of the process. The mean, what's happening is the mean is growing faster than the actual process, because every once in a while you're going to have very rare mutations that come up very early. These are going to make the tumors grow much faster than normal, and these rare sample paths are going to pull up the mean of our process. Right, so here the mean growth rate does not identify the growth rate of the actual tumor. And the other thing I want to note here is that this growth rate depends on G only through its value at the endpoint B. Okay, so let's see here. Okay, so if we let me go back to this limit here, this V1. This is sort of, you know, this represents the population, V1, sort of scaled by this factor, right? So V1 sort of represents our limiting population. So it's this V1 limit that we'd like to analyze the diversity of. And V1 is made up of a bunch of different individual clones, right? So there's going to be some clones that are big, some clones that are little. And so this is kind of a complicated representation. So what's a better way to think about this? So what we did is we took this representation, and then we arranged each one of these clones on in terms of its size, right? So now we've put each of these clones on this axis, and its position on this axis is determined by how large or how many cells there are in each clone. And what we end up with, remember, this is a random quantity, so each time we run this model, we'll get a slightly different positioning of each of these points on this line. So we'll end up with this random point process for which there's going to be an associated intensity, which tells us sort of the likelihood of points arriving in some areas of the line versus other areas of the line. So we were able to figure out the exact form of this intensity, and it turns out that we could show that this limit, this population V1, is behaving very much like a random walk, a specific type of random walk with stable increments, i.e. the increments have distributions with tails of this form. Okay, so why do we care about this? It turns out that this special representation of the limit allows us to characterize a lot of these ecological diversity measures that we're interested in. Okay, so this is one of these diversity measures, the Shannon index. So let's let P sub I be the proportional abundance of clone I in the population, i.e. the number of cells in clone I divided by the total number of cells in the population. So the Shannon index is defined as the negative of the sum of PI log PI. Some of you may recognize this as the Shannon entropy measure from information theory. Okay, so coming back to our point process representation of our population, what we can say is that our population is a sum of a bunch of points, and these points are arranged from largest to smallest. And it turns out that if we then calculate the abundance of each of these clones in the population, it actually has what's called a Poisson-Dirichlet distribution. And using that property, we can go ahead and calculate an explicit formula for the Shannon index of our population. Right, so it's not terribly clean, it's an infinite sum, but we can evaluate numerically. And I'll talk about some, I'll show some plots of this in a minute. Another index that we were interested in is called the Simpson's index. So this index is the probability that if you sample any two randomly chosen individuals from your population, whether or not these are going to be identical. Right, so in terms of our point process, we're going to take the probability of sampling one of these individuals from one type, X type I, for example, X sub I over V1, and the probability of sampling again and getting the same type, that's now we've got X sub I squared over V1 squared. And we're just going to sum this up over all the possible types. Okay, so once again, using the interesting structure of our point process limit for V1, we obtain a very simple, surprisingly simple result that the expected Simpson's index is just 1 minus alpha, where alpha is the ratio of lambda naught to lambda 1, so i.e. Related to the size of our fitness advances, this number B that we had in the beginning. Okay, so if I go ahead and plot Simpson's index and Shannon's index versus alpha, so for Simpson's index, we had 1 minus alpha. This thing decays linearly from 1 to 0. And so what this means is, so for alpha small, that means we've got very large fitness advances. So therefore, it's very likely that the population is going to be dominated by that super fit mutant population. Right, so the diversity is quite small on this end of the spectrum. Now, at this end of the spectrum, alpha is close to 1, meaning the fitness increases are very small. So these different clones have the ability to sort of compete equally with each other. So at this point, you'd expect the diversity to be quite large. Okay, so one interesting thing to note is that so Simpson's index decreases to 0 at the large diversity limit, whereas Shannon's index increases, actually diverges to infinity in the limit of large alpha. Now, what this is telling us here, the nonlinearity of the Shannon index, is showing us that in the regime of high diversity, the Shannon index is a more sensitive measure of diversity, right? Because if you've got, for example, some really, really small size clones, at the same time as you have some large clones, the Simpson's index isn't going to pick up those small clones, right? Whereas the Shannon index, because of that log pi term, it is going to be able to pick up those small clones. So when you're measuring diversity experimentally, this kind of tells us that the Shannon index is going to be more sensitive to small clone sizes. Okay, so the last diversity measure that we looked at was the dominance of the largest clone. So if we take this first point in our point process, we throw away the other points, and we just say, what's the contribution of that first point, the largest clone, to the first n largest clones? Right, so then if we take this ratio and we take n to infinity, this should tell us what the contribution of the first point is. So once again, we were able to find some very simple formulas for the limit of the inverse of this random variable, actually. And so what I'm plotting here is simulations of theta n inverse, i.e. the inverse contribution of the first clone to the first n largest clones as a function of alpha. And then the line here is sort of this theoretical value, 1 minus 1, 1 minus 1 over 1 minus alpha. So we see that as n increases to infinity, certainly we get convergence to the right limit. And the interesting thing here is, once again, out here in the limit of large diversity, or high amounts of diversity, this convergence is slower. So what's happening here? Well, when you've got a high amount of diversity in your population, you've got a lot of points sitting at the low end of your point process, right? You've got a lot of little clones competing with each other. So therefore, you're going to need to include more and more clones in order to get a good measure of diversity, in order to represent your population fully. So this convergence is getting slower in n as the amount of diversity goes up. Okay, so just to summarize sort of these few results on diversity in this model, what we found was that small values of alpha imply low levels of clonal diversity. In particular, it implies that the Simpson's index is near 1, the Shannon's index is near 0, and also, if alpha is small, this implies that the largest clone is going to make up a large fraction of your population. Okay, so in part 2, I'm going to be talking about some applications of these models to look at drug resistance. All right, so we've heard today already about what targeted therapies are and the importance of thinking about the evolution of drug resistance. And the two questions I'm going to address here using these models is, one, can we predict the emergence and the characteristics, diversity characteristics, of the resistant cell populations prior to treatment? So we're talking about pre-existing resistance here. And then two, is there any way we can prevent or delay the emergence of resistance by altering our treatment schedules? Okay, so I think everyone here is probably familiar with this, but just in case, in chronic myeloid leukemia, it's commonly treated with imatinib, tyrosine kinase inhibitor, which induces remission in a very large percentage of CML patients. There are many point mutations that have been identified that confer resistance to imatinib, and there are second-generation inhibitors, dasatinib and nilotinib, which overcome some of these mutations. And so what we were interested in was trying to characterize pre-existing resistant populations in order to decide whether or not it's a good idea to give combination therapy as first-line treatment. Okay, so this is kind of essentially the same model that I talked about before, only now our distribution of the random fitness advances is discrete and corresponds to the growth rates of the 11 most common resistant types, which I'm going to give on the next slide. Okay, so this data is taken from a paper where Brian Skaggs was the first author and Charles Floyd was the last author. And so here, basically, they took all of these different resistant cell types and then calculated the growth rates in vitro. And then over here, you can see sort of their resistance status. All right, so we did a little bit of post-processing with these birth rates and sort of normalized them using some epidemiological data to sort of get an estimate of what these rates might be like in vivo. The caveat is that the assumption is that the relative differences between all of these birth rates in vitro is the same in vivo, and that's a big assumption. But going ahead, we said that the time of diagnosis was going to be approximately when our total population size reaches size M, which we're estimating to be about 100,000 stem cells. And what we find is that even though each of our resistant mutants have different birth rates, the probability that each of them exists at diagnosis is roughly the same. So what this is telling us is that using the time scales of the problem and the ranges of fitness that we have, sort of getting the mutation is the rate-limiting step. We don't really have time before diagnosis to really let the fitness differences change the probability of seeing each of these mutations. However, the clone size distribution could vary greatly between mutants, and so here we see that there is a much higher likelihood of getting a clone of cells with the T315I mutation, which is, as we saw on the previous slide, resistant to all of these drugs, versus a clone with another mutation, such as the F317L. Okay, another thing we looked at was how many resistant types do you expect a single patient to have at the time of diagnosis. So what we find is that if detection or diagnosis occurs at sort of normal levels, 12 to 13% of patients would have at least one type of pre-existing resistance at a pretty low frequency. And then if this detection time if the patients are diagnosed later, this distribution on the number of distinct types present should sort of flatten out and move to the right, although still no more than two or three distinct types. And the last thing we did here was to look at the benefits of combination therapy over monotherapy with imatinib for two different detection sizes. So what we found is that there's not really a huge benefit for giving combination therapy in patients that are diagnosed sort of at the normal time. But if patients are diagnosed with larger disease burdens, there can be a significant benefit to giving a combination of these drugs. Okay, and so the other example that I wanted to talk about is drug resistance in EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer, which we already heard about today. And I'm going to focus on drug resistance to the tyrosine kinase inhibitors, or erlotinib and gefitinib, that's driven by a single point mutation in T790M. Right, so in 50% of patients, resistance is associated with this point mutation. Okay, so the model here is similar again, but one main thing that's different is we only have one type of resistant cell that we're interested in, this T790M. And then the other thing that's different is that the birth and death rates of these cell types can change over time, and that's going to be related to the drug concentration at a particular time. Right, so we're going to use some experimental data to determine the relationship between the drug concentration and the growth kinetics. So we're using the same PC9 cell line, and all of these experiments were done by Julie Chmielecki, who was a grad student of William Powell. And so in the top row, we have the birth rate and death rate as a function of drug concentration for the PC9 cells. So these are drug sensitive. And in the bottom row, we have the birth rate and death rate as a function of drug concentration for the erlotinib resistant PC9 cells. So these are the same, except that these cells have that T790M mutation. So we can see that the death rate doesn't really increase much in this data as a function of increasing drug concentration, whereas the birth rate of sensitive cells decreases significantly, and the birth rate of the resistant cells still decreases, but not so much. It's more of a linear relationship. Okay, so we did a little bit of model validation, and so what we these experiments were done by Shin and Lumenthaler and Parag Malik, who are part of the PSOC network. And so we just used this, you know, this is essentially a really, really simple model. The sensitive cells and the resistant cells in the model they grow independently, except for the fact that once in a while sensitive cells can give rise to resistant cells. And so as a modeler, I was actually hoping that the predictions wouldn't match up so I could put more things into the model. But in fact, it seemed that the predictions matched up very well. So what you're looking at here is sort of the cell number. If we start with a mixture of sensitive and resistant cells, so here Shannon's labeled them red and green, if we start with some pre-specified mixture of them and we grow them up over time in various drug concentrations, what does the model predict is in the circles, and then the experimental data is connected by the lines. And so she did this for a whole bunch of different admixtures in various drug concentrations. And overall, this is sort of typical of what you would see. There's not really there's a small amount of error between the model and experiment. It's always less than 10%. Okay, so another thing we did was to sort of predict how long it takes for a polyclonal population to become sort of resensitized, right? So here, Julie and William Powell started with an initial population, a mixed population, and they sort of measured percent growth inhibition over the course of time to see when this polyclonal population would become sensitive again. So if we look at the model, it's a very simple one-line calculation just to see that it should take 35 to 40 days for this population to become sensitized again. And then what we saw in the experiment was that this resensitization occurred between passage 8 and 16. I don't think she checked in between. So with 3 days per passage, this matches up very well with the model prediction. Okay, so what did we do with this model? What we were interested in doing was sort of using it to test out a whole bunch of different theoretical dosing strategies to see whether we could delay the time until the emergence of resistance. So taking into account a lot of, you know, as much data as I could find on the toxicity that has been reported in clinical trials of erlotinib, we identified an alternate tolerated schedule, or we think that should be tolerated, that we think should delay resistance. And this schedule is, I'm going to give this in terms of the concentrations, and then you should sort of imagine an oral intake that would give rise to these concentrations, and I realize that there's a whole field of study related to that. That this schedule should be 20 micromolar pulse once per week, plus a very low dose schedule the rest of the week. And just to give you a comparison, the current sort of approved schedule is 3 micromolar every single day. So this 1 micromolar is very low. Okay, so what you're looking at here is some in vitro testing of this optimized schedule versus continuous low-dose erlotinib. This is another drug which is very similar to erlotinib, but a little bit more potent, so we actually used that for the high-dose pulse instead of a large dose of erlotinib. So this little red line here represents the T790M mutation. So it's absent in the parental line, as we expect. Now, if we put the cells in sort of the standard daily dose, or continuous three micromolar, we see that within less than 3 months, we see the emergence of resistance. And the same thing with BAVW2992. Whereas after 6 months on the optimized schedule, we still haven't seen this emergence yet. Okay, then moving on, the last thing we did, or the most recent thing we did, was we wanted to look at the effect of pharmacokinetic variability on drug resistance. And so the data that we had, that we found in a CCR paper from 2007, was on the concentration in the plasma of erlotinib after one dose in two cohorts of patients, smokers and never smokers. Right, and so we're sort of using this data. We're not particularly interested in smokers and non-smokers clinically because this drug is not usually given to smokers. But we wanted to use this data as sort of a realistic indication of how large is the range of variability in pharmacokinetics in a population. So what we see is that for the smokers, the drug is, this is a log scale over time, the drug is eliminated much faster than for non-smokers. And the same is true if you give 300 milligrams versus 150 milligrams. So if we just put this into a standard PK pharmacokinetic model, this is sort of the concentration over number of days that you would find. So the non-smokers on 150 milligram a day, so that 150 is the standard dose. So the non-smokers sort of reach, this is the red line, if they reach the steady state around 3. And then the smokers have a much lower steady state because they're eliminating the drugs faster, but they're still taking the same amount. So it has been sort of suggested that smokers should take twice as much. So if we go ahead and plot that, that brings us up to the same steady state as the non-smokers. So if we put this concentration profile into our model and calculate the probability of developing resistance, what we can see is that, so the red line here is non-smokers, and then the blue line is smokers, and then the black line is smokers taking 300 milligrams a day versus 150. So we see that we do see an increase in the probability of developing resistance for smokers, and if they take a double dose, it will help things, but it will not get us back down to the levels for non-smokers. And the last thing that we did was to look at the effects of compliance. So if you miss a dose. So once again, here are some concentration profiles in a standard PK model. If the red line here is if you miss 2 days, And then the black line is if you miss 2 days and then take double your dose the following 2 days, sort of make up for it. And the probability of resistance that results from this is that if you miss 2 days, your probability of resistance increases. If you try to make it up, it doesn't really change the outcome. Okay, so in summary, in the first part of the talk, I talked about a branching model of tumorigenesis, and we talked about some mathematical measures of diversity that have arisen in ecology. And then we applied this model to try and understand the development of resistance in CML and on small cell lung cancer. And we hope that this kind of modeling will provide some useful information to understand interpatient variability in drug response and designing the design of drug schedules. So I'd just like to put up acknowledgments of all of my collaborators involved in various aspects of both the modeling and the experiments. That's it. Thanks.